Based. Oh, hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. How are you doing? I became a Buddhist recently because I realised that the only path to enlightenment. No, look, I didn't really become a Buddhist. I was lying. But today I would like to talk about the issue of Buddhism. And specifically, I would like to talk about an idea which was presented to me at my recent meet and greet in London, which is that at the group level, not at the individual level, I'll talk about that later, but at the group level, we have become rather like very, very successful Buddhists. Because what being a very successful Buddhist involves doing is, in effect, extinguishing yourself. And extinguishing yourself, coming into the whole, no longer existing, breaking free of the cycle of life and ceasing to exist in a very specific way. And that, as a group, is what we seem to have done. Now, there's an idea, E.O. Wilson put this forth in his book, Consilience, that basically the only good thing about the humanities, or about most humanities subjects, is coming up with useful metaphors which help us to make sense of the way things are. And a lot of humanities research involves basically trading different metaphors and nuancing different metaphors. Now, that is a use, because metaphors allow you to comprehend something, allow you to better make sense of it. And once you have that eureka moment, that enlightenment moment, if you will, where something makes sense, which it can do through metaphor, then you can move on and you can kind of develop it further once you've got it in your mind. And I think the idea that at the group level we are rather like very successful Buddhists that thus extinguish ourselves is a very interesting metaphor. So let me explain. The idea in Buddhism, according to the Buddha, is that we all go through an eternal cycle of rebirths. This is known as samsara. During samsara, this cycle of continuous rebirths, we go through suffering, continuous suffering. This is known as dukkha. Now, the Buddha comes up with something called dharma, and the dharma is a process, a method, via which you can free yourself from the eternal cycle of suffering, dukkha, through various ways. In particular, you must understand the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are, firstly, that all life is suffering, all life is dukkha. Secondly, that dukkha, suffering, is caused by desire, and the desire involves clinging to things, involves clinging to material things that you see as real and so forth, and wanting them. But those material things are themselves transient. Those material things aren't really real. The nature of everything is transient. All water flows into the sea. In a sense, nothing is real. And that you can achieve a breaking free of this system via nirvana, via ascending, breaking free of the system through nirvana. Now, how do you do that? How do you attain nirvana? You do so through concentration, that is to say, samadhi, and through morality, moral behaviour, that is to say, sila. And when you engage in those things, then you are able to meditate. And when you are able to meditate, you are basically able, I don't know if any of you have ever meditated, ever given it a go, it's effectively a kind of self-hypnosis. And when you are able to do so, you lose the sense of self. You lose the sense of self, and you enter into a kind of nothingness. It's the sense of self goes, and you have a feeling of oneness with the world. You have a feeling of eternity. You have a feeling that just everything makes sense, and you're able to simply rise above it. This obviously imbues you with a sense that life is okay, that everything's going to be all right, that life isn't pointless or whatever, and it allows you to overcome various problems with life that you may have. So I would argue that it's probably an adaptive thing to do. One could argue that prayer is, for people that engage in it fervently, is really just a form of meditation in which you focus on God until, and a lot of the Christian mystics describe this, you break free of the self and you have this sense of oneness with God and oneness with the universe, and everything just seems to make sense. In much the same way, there are certain tribes in the Amazon, for example, that take powerful hallucinogenic drugs, and the taking of these hallucinogenic drugs provides you with a breaking free of the self, a sense of oneness, a sense of wholeness, in much the same way that meditation does. And if you want to see something about that, there's a very interesting documentary by Bruce Parry where he spends time with some Amazon tribe or other and takes ayahuasca and has this very, very intense experience. So that really is how you break free of things. And once you break free of things, then, of course, you have nirvana, and you've broken free, apparently, according to Buddhism, of the cycle of life. Sometimes, by the way, they do this by focusing on death specifically. So they specifically think about death and the fact that death could come at any time. This is known as Maransatsu, and it happens among the sort of Zen Buddhists of Japan. You focus on death, and therefore you enter a sense of nirvana or whatever, enlightenment, through focusing constantly on death. Now, how have we done this at the group level? Well, at the group level, let's follow this metaphor. At the group level, you all life, you're breaking free, you're trying to break free of the cycle of life, to break free of the dukkha. Well, all life is suffering. To a very great extent, in terms of our group, we have broken free of suffering. Our mortality salience is incredibly low. Most of us do not experience the death of a child or the death of a brother or sister in childhood, or the death of a parent in childhood. Death is not sudden. Death is not all around us. Death is controlled. Death is, there are exceptions, of course, but death is relatively predictable. Death is extended and pushed off well into old age. Death is not sudden, whatever. So we don't have that form of suffering. Another form of suffering key to the whole history of humanity is not having enough food. We don't have that form of suffering. We've got food. We've got more food than we could possibly eat, to the extent that it is a sign of poverty to be fat, a sign of poverty. There was this program I was watching last night about two sisters in America that are incredibly fat. And incredibly low IQ and whatever, from, I know, somewhere in the south of America. That's how much food we have. We have no problem. We have constant access to heat. We have constant access to how we have constant access to entertainment and things that could allow us to enjoy life. We have never lived. We have never truly suffered. We don't know what it is to suffer. We think that we're highly moral, but really what that's a reflection of is of our warm beds and of our full stomachs. Our morality has never really been tested. It will be, perhaps, but it has not been tested during our lifetimes. Us people who are Generation X or whatever, or Zoomers or whatever. No, we don't know what it is to suffer. So we've broken free, essentially, of suffering. We don't suffer anymore in any realistic way. We are the wealthiest, most content people. Now, this, of course, leads to a dysphoria. That's another issue. This leads to a dysphoria, a sense that things aren't quite right, because we're in an evolutionary mismatch. We're meant to have suffering. We're meant to have, life is meant to be a struggle that you fight for and you fight to win. We're meant to have these things. And so we feel a sense of boredom, and we feel a sense that things aren't quite right. And this results in a different kind of suffering. Perhaps it results in a sort of a vague depression and a feeling, oh, I don't really want to have children. What's the point? You know, what's the point in that? But in terms of real suffering, we don't have it. We've overcome that. The second is that this idea that at the group level, therefore, our group does not suffer. The second thing is this idea of desire and this idea of accepting that all life, everything is transient. Everything is transient. Nothing is real. Well, we certainly accepted that. That is the essence of postmodern dogma. That is the essence of the postmodern Christian heresy. Nothing is real. Everything is a production of power. We question what everything is. There is no such thing. What do we mean by intelligence? What do we mean by this? What do we mean by that? Where do you draw the line between this? Where do you draw the line between that? Nothing is. We don't really have a concrete sense that anything is real. Indeed, we accept that there is no such thing as reality at all. There is no such thing as objective truth. Truth, all truth is. And the whole concept of truth is simply an attempt by which people in power will impose themselves on people that don't have power by asserting that they have this objective truth, and this objective truth that they assert is inherently in their power interests. And we must challenge this objective truth, which is in the interests of those in power, in favour of those that do not have power. But when they reach power, then of course they will just do the same thing. So there is no objective truth. There is no such thing as truth. There is nothing. We don't understand anything. What do we mean by sex? What do we mean by gender? The result of that is that we can choose who we are. We can assert who we are. We can create our own sense of selves. There is no such thing as genuine truth, as genuine reality. And certainly at the level of the nation, there is no such thing as ethnicity. There is no such thing as race. There is, all of these things merge into each other. They are all transient. There is nothing real and concrete that we can hold on to. It can all be questioned. We've accepted that. And because we've accepted that, therefore, unlike perhaps Ukrainians at the moment, we should of course have no problem with immigration. We should of course have no problem with people moving all over the place, because there is no such thing as a nation. What do you mean by a nation? What do you mean by a people? It's all transient. It's all based around power. It's all unfixed. It all flows into the sea. So we have no longer any sense of nationhood, any sense of our own eternity, any sense of anything that is fundamentally true. Everything is transient. Now, once you accept those things, then you can start to be on your way to nirvana. You can start to become, how do you become on your way to nirvana? Well, you start meditating and whatever. How can you do that? Well, as a people, you have to have be rich, basically. You could argue that one of the things about Buddha and Jesus and all these kinds of people is the reason why they were able to break free of society and become wanderers and sages is because ultimately they had financial backup. Some of Jesus' followers were fishermen, but they had both Greek and Hebrew names. This implies that the only people that could speak Greek that were Jews at that time were extremely wealthy people. So this implies they were extremely wealthy. When they say they were fishermen, what it actually means is they had a company that fished. So they had money. They had something they could go back to if things went wrong. Buddha was a member of a small royal family. He had money. He had something he could go back to if things went wrong. So being secure in terms of not really having much suffering, and in terms of being able to contemplate ideas like what does everything mean and whatever, the next step is that you can spend your life as a wandering individual holy man, totally focused on you and totally focused on your feelings and developing your own feelings and whatever. And this is what we do as a people now. This is what we do as a group. We are focused on our own feelings, on our own sense of enlightenment, on our own feeling that we have reached something important in life, on the highest level of Maslow's hierarchy of values, at the bottom of which is basically being fed and having food, and then there's above that there's having property and security, and then above that there's having status, and then above that there's sort of self-enlightenment. Well, that's where we are as a group. And once you focus on that as a group, then, of course, you've no sense of yourself as a group. You've no sense of yourself having a sense of eternity. You've no suffering to motivate you to do anything. And so you can just extinguish yourself. And that is what these societies tend to do. Once they reach this stage in which there is no longer any material suffering in a material sense, in which they start then questioning everything and saying that, oh, everything's transient. What do we mean by this? What do we mean by that? What do we mean by nationality? Questioning all of the old ideas, questioning who they are such they don't know who they are. Then, of course, they accept that they are transient, that they're not going to go on, and they start to merge into other things because they don't cling to anything concrete, anything, any idea that they're eternal. And then they simply become focused as a people on things like Gnosticism, on these kinds of ideas of reaching spiritual enlightenment or whatever, or on all the kind of neo-Gnosticisms that we have now, where the world is ultimately an evil and dark place, and we just have to get through it, which is also a kind of Buddhist idea, isn't it? The world is suffering, that life is suffering. Perhaps you could argue that Buddhism is the Gnosticism of the East in that sense. And then once you start doing that, then it's over. You no longer have a sense of your own importance. You go into the sea. You fall apart as a group. You essentially you focus on meditation as a group, on self-indulgence, and you extinguish yourself. And at the most extreme among individual Buddhists, you have a concept among Zen Buddhists called Sokushun Butos Ombutsu, where the Buddhist monk will meditate to death. He will simply meditate, keep doing it, keep being in a state of meditation until he dies. And that, in effect, one could argue, is what the West is engaging in. The West is engaging in Sokushun Butsu, in which we have stopped having a sense of ourselves, stopped having a sense of who we are, stopped having any suffering, and therefore we reach nirvana and we simply meditate to death. Now, what we need to be in order to survive is the asava, as it's known in Buddhism, is those who leak out, those who do not reach enlightenment. It is the asava at the group level, those that do not go down this path, those that do not that continue to suffer, that continue to have desire and attachment to certain clear concepts, that continue to assert that certain things, such as their group identity, are not transient but are eternal, and who do not focus on the inward and so forth. It is those people, the asava, who manage to survive. So in that sense, then, I think you could argue that at the group level, we are like the Buddha. Now, I may have Buddhist viewers, and I must emphasize that this is a kind of a heresy, a Buddhist heresy. I am talking about the group level. I am not talking about the individual level. At the individual level, we're not acting like Buddhists at all, are we? At the individual level, we are extremely materialistic. We are more so than ever. We are extremely unspiritual. We are extremely strongly attached to material things. So in that sense, there is no way in which it can be argued, ironically, that as individuals we are behaving anything like Buddhists. Moreover, it could be argued that there is something quite adaptive about Buddhism in a religious sense. It is a means via which you can cope with death and whatever, and cope with the uncertainty of life and so forth. The practice of meditation further allows you to do that, and it will fill you with positive feelings, which will help you to get through life and will be adaptive. The monks themselves could be argued to be group selected because they imbue the group with a sense of its own religious importance and its own eternal importance and so forth. The dietary practices could be argued to be elevating health and making health something religious sanctioned. So no, the fact that Buddhism has survived implies in itself, for all these centuries, implies that it is an adaptive religion at the individual level, and even an adaptive religion for an organization to take up within certain limitations. But all I want to make clear in this video is the idea that at the group level, we are behaving as the extremely enlightened Buddha, which is that we go through a certain process whereby we extinguish suffering, which we have, whereby we start saying everything's transient, which we and doesn't exist, which we do say, and therefore in which we experience a sense of nirvana, in which we just extinguish ourselves and become part of the whole, in which the sense of group self goes, in which we really become like sort of cats that are just in a trance, that no longer have a sense of self-awareness. And when that happens, then the group, of course, goes, and it is the group that maintains a sense of certainty, that maintains a sense of suffering and struggle, that carries on. It is the group that maintains a sense of asava. Okay, well, I hope that has been of interest, and if it has, then please subscribe. It really helps me violently if you do that. Remember, you could want to help the channel. You can see where to do so below. Remember, I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, and I will see you soon. And goodbye!